have reached, 1, has been changed. The new number is 2. Please make a note of it.
Please repeat.
The number you have reached has been changed. The new number has been disconnected.
Ring damage.
Möchten Sie etwas zu trinken haben?
No. Just hold on a minute. Well, actually 30 seconds, okay? We cheated a bit. Don't know if anyone listened to commercial radio this past week. Sometimes it happens. Sometimes we accidentally stray into that part of the dial. But I don't know what day it was. I think it was Thursday. Almost every commercial radio station in the nation had 30 seconds of silence. It was to demonstrate a point that if people don't talk or play music or commercials on the radio, you hear silence. Now, that's a very progressive type of conclusion for commercial radio to reach. But they did this past week, and I'm just sorry we weren't a part of it. That's why our belated 30 seconds of silence occurred at 10:03 on Saturday night. We've been requested to bring you lots more silence in the future, and we'll be looking into that as one of our new programs. It's 4 minutes after 10 o'clock now, and why don't we get back to the intro. This is Brain Damage.
If you do not push a key in 3 seconds, you will be disconnected.
Mein Bruder ist jünger als ich.
Thank you.
picture that you gave to me, and it's signed with love, just like it used to be. The only thing different, the only thing new, I've got your picture. She's got you. I've got the records that we used to share, and they still sound the same as when you were here. The only thing different, the only thing new, I've got the records. I've got your memory, or has it got me? I really don't know, but I know it won't let me be. I've got your class ring that proves you care, and it still looks the same as when you gave it, dear. The only thing different, the only thing new, I've got these little things, she's got you. I've got your memory, or has it got me? That proved you care, and it still looks the same as when you gave it, dear. The only thing different, the only thing new, I've got these little things, she's got.
Well, now that just goes to show you the power of radio. That's why I opened the program up with a musical piece like that, because I imagine there are some folks out there might be driving around in their cars, flying in their private airplanes. Don't laugh, it happens. People listen to us up there. Sitting in their homes, doing what people do in their homes, and feeling in a rather chipper, good mood. Nice spring day. Rained a little bit, but then it brightened up. Forecast is for sun. It's a holiday weekend. In a good kind of mood, you know? Gonna see some friends and family and that kind of thing. And then WUSB plays a Patsy Cline song, and you want to jump off a building. You want to die a slow, painful death, because that will make your life comparable to Patsy Cline, one of the most, I don't know how to describe her, one of the best singers I know of. And of course, she's not alive anymore either. She died in a plane crash, which was unfortunate, because I'm sure she would have liked to have written a song about it. About having an unsuccessful love affair on a plane that's going down in flames. Back into a world that doesn't care. So, now that we know that everybody is miserable out there, you're ready for the next stop on our trip. And I've always wanted to do this. I've always wanted to have kind of a match point between the two most miserable people I know, Not personally, but I know their voices. And of course, Patsy Cline is one of them. We've just heard from her. And the other, one of my all-time favorites, Edith Piaf. Now, I'd like you to think to yourself, and perhaps out loud if there are people around you, which one do you think deserves to be sadder? I want you to think really hard now. I want you to concentrate and stay away from anything sharp. Edith.
C'est une aventure bizarre, comme le train qui fait la gare, il a fondu dans le couloir. Et le tronc contre la portière, il regardait sur la lumière de Paris mourant dans le soir. Un train dans la nuit vous emporte, derrière toi, des amours mortes. Elle, on voudrait aimer encore. La banlieue triste qui s'ennuie, dès qu'il est morne sous la pluie. Il regardait toujours dehors. Le train roulait dans la nuit sombre, l'homme déjà n'était qu'une ombre, et d'être seul avec toi. Il a parlé, qu'a-t-il pu dire? Je ne revois que son sourire quand il vint s'asseoir près de moi. Un train dans la nuit vous emporte, derrière soi, des amours mortes, et dans le cœur, un vague ennui. Alors sa main a pris la mienne. Et j'avais peur que le jour vienne. J'étais si bien tout contre lui. Lorsque je me suis éveillée dans une gare ensoleillée, l'inconnu sautait sur le quai. Alors des hommes l'entourèrent et tête basse ils l'emmenèrent. Tandis que le train repartait, j'ai regardé par la portière, comme en un geste de prière, l'homme vers moi tendait les mains. Le soleil redoublait ma peine et faisait miroiter des chaînes. C'était peut-être un assassin. Il y a des gens bizarres dans les trains et dans les arts.
And there she is, winner of France's Most Miserable Creature Award. That was back in the 40s, and certainly a lot has happened since then. Le Chasseur de l'Hôtel, which translates to the Bellboy of the Hotel. No, wait a minute, that's not what we heard. I'm sorry, that was the song before that. We heard Paris Méditerranée, which translates to, you ready? Paris Mediterranean. The title refers to that train which links Paris to Marseille and the Riviera. Symbolically, it also links the rain to the sun, the darkness to the light, a recurrent image in most of Piaf's songs. The story? Two strangers meet on the Mediterranean-bound train. A girl and a man. Oh, how sexist can you get? These old record covers. What, a 12-year-old girl and a 36-year-old man? Not the kind of thing you write a song about, is it? Obviously, a man and a woman. Women didn't quite earn their place yet, and it was a man's world. Anyway, they are both lonely people. We know very little about the girl, and even less about the man, except for the fact that he is arrested. Maybe he was an assassin. Well, those are two miserable songwriters and singers, neither one of which is alive today. And now that everybody's depressed, we're going to cheer you up to demonstrate the further power of radio. In fact, to demonstrate how far radio has come, how far this particular radio program is going to be coming.
Saturdays are party. WUSB.
I don't know where he came from, but yes, that's true. Saturday's a party lister. Thank you very much. It's now 17 minutes after 10 o'clock. It's Saturday night, and we have our traditional program from Radio Moscow all lined up and ready to go. Now, the folks at Radio Moscow are, of course, interested in how the show is received here, not reception-wise, and well, I'm sure we'd be interested in hearing that. But one of the things that people have been saying about the program, now we've been airing Moscow Mailbag pretty regularly at this time, and one thing that people have been requesting pretty consistently is more people-oriented material, more how is life in the Soviet Union. They want to hear the voices of the Soviet Union, the actual people. So I conveyed that information to Radio Moscow. Yes, that's right. I typed up a little letter and sent it over there. And lo and behold, this week in the mail, we got a new tape. This is called Radio Bridge. And it represents just what you want to hear, a bridge between people in England and people in Moscow. A live phone-in program. Now, obviously, it's not live. This took place a few weeks ago, but it's being presented here on Brain Damage, which is a live phone-in program. So what more appropriate way of doing things than this? And, of course, we'll be taking your calls after the show. I mean, after the Radio Moscow show, not after our show. So give a listen to this, and then give a call to us at 632-6901.
On the final day of Mikhail Gorbachev's recent visit to Britain, the British section of Radio Moscow and London Broadcasting Company organized a live phone-in program. Hugo Young of The Guardian in London and Boris Belitsky of Radio Moscow and Richard Alibegov of the Progress Publishing House in Moscow answered listeners' questions about Soviet-British relations and the processes of perestroika and glasnost in the Soviet Union. The program was presented by Brian Hayes of LBC, who began the discussion by asking Hugo Young, Mrs. Thatcher's biographer, to outline her most distinctive features as a politician. Mr. Young summed up by saying that Mrs. Thatcher is a dedicated and conviction prime minister. The same question then was put to Boris Belitsky with respect to Mikhail Gorbachev.
Well, I would certainly say that he is a conviction president. Mr. Gorbachev is very deeply committed, that is felt by everyone, to his beliefs. And these beliefs, at the moment, reflect the prevailing, I would say the extremely prevailing view among the citizens of this country. This is the view that the country is very badly in need of change. And Mr. Gorbachev epitomizes that feeling of the need for change in the country. For this reason, he is held in very high esteem, is very widely admired, and wields enormous influence.
How does public opinion make itself known in your country?
It makes itself known in a variety of means nowadays. Unfortunately, this was not true in the past. Just now, it is making itself known through elections to the Congress of People's Deputies, as our new parliament is now called. These elections have shown extremely widespread support for the need for change and thereby for the policy of perestroika, introduced and championed by President Gorbachev. This is one way in which public opinion manifests itself. We also have, of course, the media, through which the people are able to express their feelings. They write to the media, be it to newspapers, here at Radio Moscow, television, and in this way, they use another very important channel for making public opinion felt. And thirdly, there are numerous public organizations, all kinds of organizations, that unite various groups of people according to their occupations, interests, hobbies, whatnot. And these organizations also have numerous ways of making their membership's views felt.
Mr. Elebegov of the Progress Publishing House, we should introduce you now. One of your specialty areas is ethnic problems in the Soviet Union, and I wonder, is it that will be a great problem for the Soviet president?
Well, in a way, yes, but actually this problem deals with the overall decentralization in this country. It is not only by the ethnic patterns that the decentralization should go, but also by regional patterns and so on. So ethnic problems, if this is understood as, say, intercommunal hostility, yes, then this might be a problem. And now we are trying to deal with this. For instance, the hostilities between Armenians and the Azerbaijanians in the Caucasus. But in general, I do not think that this will be a separate problem with which they'll have to deal. If this will be just part of the whole big drive for decentralization. Now, I'd also like to add to what Boris just said about how they express their public opinion here in this country. Also, by way of various marches, demonstrations and meetings in the streets and in the clubs, for instance, which was especially noticeable during the election campaign. You could see numerous demonstrations, meetings in Moscow. And also, I know, I happen to be, say, in Tbilisi, here's an ethnic republic, the Georgian Republic, and there you could see lots of marches and demonstrations and whole meetings, say, a stadium of 80,000 and filled to capacity. So this is yet another way of expressing the public opinion.
Well, I just would love to ask Russian colleagues. We see here frequently on television now that it's much easier to report from the Soviet Union, one sees a lot of really political activity, particularly in Lithuania and other outlying areas, also in Georgia earlier on. What I am fascinated to hear, really, is whether you feel that this move, this great thrust for decentralization, can be cut off long before the urge for separation becomes irresistible.
Well, I don't think that there will be a really strong urge for separation, because these republics are tied together by economic relations, you see, and the urge for separation, it's not realistic.
But aren't the national feelings, now they've finally been liberated and freed, aren't they rising up to a point which really gives the central government real grounds for fear?
No, I don't think that there are real grounds of fear about the urge for separation. Although, of course, these republics want and should have more autonomy, more say in their own affairs. For instance, in deciding their language problems. For instance, in Estonia, as far as I can remember, they recently introduced the law whereby all officials have got to speak Estonian. They also introduce certain corrections, say, in the spelling of the Russian language in their proper names. For instance, the capital city Tallinn is now spelt in Russian with a double N at the end, you see. All these things, but I don't think that this urge for separation, it's there, but it's not a predominant urge. I don't think it'll turn into any big problem.
But the economic links are obviously very important, but this does not, of course, preclude national separation. The European Economic Community is an example of this. These nations are tied together quite strongly because of their economies being linked through the community, but they are different national identities and they have separate governments.
Let me remind to you that when this country was first founded, it was founded as a union of republics. See?
Yes.
So, well, there you are. It's a union of sovereign republics. That's what it's got to be. Although we know that for a long time, of course, this factor was to a great degree suppressed.
On the telephone first this morning is George from Hampstead. Hello.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. Can I start off by saying how refreshing it is to hear a politician who is genuinely speaking of peace and cooperation between nations? I sense that if Mr. Gorbachev was leader of the leading opposition on this island, he'd win an overwhelming majority of public support. Having said that, we are told over here that Mrs. Thatcher is very popular in Moscow and in Russia generally. Is this true? And if so, why? Because she's not very popular over here.
Who would like to answer that question in
Moscow? Well, let me, Boris Belitsky speaking. I think that the prevailing feeling for Mrs. Thatcher in this country is one of very sincere admiration. Now, admiration does not necessarily imply complete agreement with everything she says. That is probably lacking in very great measure. But the admiration is certainly there. Mrs. Thatcher has spoken on Soviet television several times. There was a long interview with her just the other evening, and I've spoken to many people who watched it, and they spoke with great admiration of the way Mrs. Thatcher answered questions. People really do feel that she is a woman of convictions. We also admire Mrs. Thatcher for the fact that she was the first Western leader to appreciate the importance of perestroika in the Soviet Union and of General Secretary Gorbachev's role in leading this reform policy in our country. So my feeling is that the prevailing attitude to her is one of genuine admiration.
Now, it's Bob calling from Neasden next on the telephone. Hello, Bob.
Hello, Brian. I've got a question. First of all, I'd like to applaud the changes Mr. Gorbachev is trying to make in the Soviet Union. One of these changes is filling in the blank spots of Soviet history, i.e. The times of Stalin, etc. Now that these crimes are coming to light, more or less, for instance, 7 million Ukrainians killed in an artificial famine in 1933, mass executions in Bukovina near Kyiv, etc. And the question I've got is, how far do the Soviet authorities think of taking these matters? Because it's many of the people that were responsible for these crimes are still alive today, and a lot of them are in the what you can say in the party hierarchy even today. And I don't think it's enough to just mention these crimes. I think they should be these people should be taken to task. They should be made responsible.
What you mean, something like a tribunal?
Yes, I think along the lines of an international tribunal, because along the lines of Nuremberg, for instance, the crimes were just as great as the crimes committed by the Nazis, and it would be very difficult for a system that was responsible for the crimes to actually judge itself.
Let me put this then to you, Richard Ellerbengel, for this may be an area that interests you.
Well, in the first place, this is a matter of great debate here in this country too, but of course the gentleman Bob is mistaken when he says that there are people still in the hierarchy today who are responsible for these crimes in the past. No, let me tell you that within the past 2 or 3 years, something like 70% of the party secretaries have been changed across the country, and this is only the recent change. Think of the earlier changes. Now, in general, about this, whether to put them on trial or not, there are different opinions. Some people call for this, some do not. They say that public contempt is enough for them. And among these people, even those who were victims or whose parents fell victims to this repression, because they say the main thing for us is not to quarrel, to divide the nation over these things, but to march forward. Well, So, you see, I do not think that there will be real trials of these people. Most of them are already very old, but there's another thing. There's a drive, for instance, of depriving them of their very comfortable, very handsome pensions. Because people say, look, they committed these things in the past, and at the same time they live very, very comfortably with a very big pension. While we have people, say, victims of these times, who have very small pensions, this is unjust, they say, and I think they're right here.
Is your concern that in coming to terms with this part of the history of the Soviet Union, there has got to be a great deal of care so that there is not a division opening up rather than bringing the nation together, nations together?
Well, as many people point out, there is a division already over the issue of Stalin, because there's a sizable number of people here in this country who still have nostalgia for Stalin and Stalin's times as a strong hand.
Mm.
They are not in any majority, no, but they are there also. Other people, they sort of hesitate and they say, well, the man has died, why bother his memory and so on, etc. It's like this. So you see, we have enough other problems here in this country responsible for various rifts here. The struggle between, say, production and the ministries, the ministers' huge monopolies and so on. Many other problems. So they prefer just to disclose everything, to lay everything bare open, to fill in these blank spots in history, yes, to name the people, for instance, that investigator Hvat who tortured academician Vavilov, for instance, like this, and this Hvat, this investigator, doesn't know how to come out into the street, because people hate him.
On the telephone next, Ken from Battersea, good morning.
Good morning, Brian, good morning to your guests. I want to refer to Hugo Young in his opening remarks in regard to his conception of Mrs. Thatcher, where he says that to put in all politics aside, etc., all the little things, blah, 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 she has an insatiable attitude to her work and to her job. I don't doubt that, Mr. Young. And this sort of attitude that you put over, that she's trying to be the mother of the nation, etc., etc., and a very dedicated woman. Yes, she is a very dedicated woman, but dedicated to her class. And the class are the rich people. I mean, you have only got to look round this country, and when you talk about insatiable, I would say instability. Because never, I don't think, has such a woman, being the Prime Minister, created so much instability amongst the population of this country. It seems to me the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer.
Let's ask Hugo Young to respond to that, then.
Well, first of all, I think that I would certainly never describe her as the mother of the nation, nor ever imagine that she was the mother of the nation. Now, as to the question of her class and the rich and the poor, I don't dispute that the rich have got richer and the poor have got poorer, nor would I dispute that actually she is more interested in successful people than she is in, shall we say, the 20% of people who could generally, for various all sorts of reasons, be described as the hard luck cases of the unsuccessful people. But I think you've got to sort of address yourself to the fact that in that time, in this decade, an awful lot of people in the middle have also got more prosperous, and prosperity is an acclaim or promise which is made not just by the Conservative Party, but by the Labour Party, indeed, I would imagine, by the Communist Party, if there were such a thing alive being in this country. All politicians will say to the people, we will make you richer. Now, Mrs. Thatcher, whatever else one may say about her, in this decade, an awful lot of people in the middle have got better off.
Thank you very much indeed, Ken. I wonder whether Boris Belitsky, there is any perception in the Soviet Union of the kind of remark you've just heard made of Mrs. Thatcher, or is Mrs. Thatcher's image there one mostly of her role on the international scene?
We naturally realize that Mrs. Thatcher represents a certain class. This is no secret to us. But at the same time, while we do not share her politics, we would like to refrain from what might be seen, especially on a program such as this, as meddling in the affairs of another country. So while we do disagree with some of her internal policies, we also consider that that is a matter for the British people, not for us to pass judgment on.
But is it, could I just interrupt and ask you, do you feel by the same token that it is not for us to pass judgment on your internal situation, or do you actually welcome the sort of observations made not just by Mrs. Thatcher, but by increasing numbers of people in this country as we examine the Soviet Union and in effect pass a sort of moral and political judgment on it?
I think that on the whole, today especially, we do welcome suggestions, criticisms, comments. We are, as I said, in the process of change, and we feel that although some opinions might reflect stereotypes formed in distant days of the Cold War, other opinions might contain a constructive element which we can use in our work, in our process of change.
Now, if I could add also about the people's attitudes here towards Mrs. Thatcher, the thing is that for a man on the street, you see, they would not go deep into British domestic politics or anything like this. They just liked the way Mrs. Thatcher looks. They liked the way she spoke, and they very much liked the way she talked with the three correspondents last year.
I believe she demolished them.
Yes, to a very high degree, and in the opinion of many people. So, and they liked it, people here. You see? So that's also a source, a very important source of her, let's say, even a certain popularity among the population here in the Soviet Union.
We thank Ken for calling in. We go to the next line, and Robin is on the line there from Camberley. Hello.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning, gentlemen. Yes, whilst supporting and thinking how wonderful these developments are, gentlemen, I just ask you a question, if I may, and just build up to it very quickly. Mr. Gorbachev has, as it were, come from behind, and what is happening in your country is fantastic. He has a reign of office of 10 years, if I'm correct, four of which have passed. His comments this morning at the Guildhall are even more reassuring, but given Mrs. Thatcher's cautious approach to total nuclear disarmament, do you feel, really honestly, that there is any possibility that with the enormous economic problems to be resolved, domestic problems generally, in your country, is there any possibility at all, if these were not resolved fast enough, that perhaps when Mr. Gorbachev's reign comes to an end, if I may call it that, is there any possibility at all of another dark horse, a protege of one of the 30% of the old style hierarchy, the Stalinist types, coming from behind, and perhaps, as we saw regrettably in Germany in the 30s, leading a nation of dissatisfied people into a more militant attitude? Is that possible?
Well, I would point out, first of all, that the policy of Glasnost, of openness to public scrutiny, now so popular in this country, is, in effect, a safeguard against any repetition of the past. The people today, throughout the length and breadth of the country, know the secrets of the past. And that is something they didn't know before. And this knowledge, as it spreads and as it builds up, is, I think, a very important guarantee that we will never have a recurrence of what happened, say, in 37 or 38.
Well, perhaps I could also add, the fact that you are able to say that over the radio from Moscow today is in itself very reassuring in that respect.
I think so, too.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Robin. Now, on the telephone, calling from Edgware in London, Mari, good morning.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning to your guests. Pamyat, a nasty, fascist, anti-Semitic organization, has now come to the fore in the Soviet Union. Do not think that there is a danger that as Mr. Gorbachev proceeds with changes in the economic system, causing those who have been privileged to lose their privileges, the Pamyat will choose the opportunity to stir up hatred between different ethnic minorities and the Soviet people as a whole.
A question for you, I think, Mr. Alibegov.
Yes, exactly. Well, in the first place, I'm very glad to hear that people in England know about Pamyat. Now, another point. Pamyat has already become a bad word. You can say, for instance, somebody behaves rudely or badly or chauvinistically in the street or, say, in the subway, in the metro, and you will say, huh, you're from Pamyat. Oh, no, I'm not, they'll say. You see, this is already a bad word. But this organization or movement does exist, actually. Yes, there is a danger.
Does it have very much of a support, very much of a following?
No. Well, it has some following because you can notice them. First of all, they're very, very noisy. They can even come and disrupt a whole meeting. For instance, in the Pravda newspaper club. Once they did so. There were only 70 of them, but they were very well organized, yes. And there was a big article about this in our media, about this event, and we were asking ourselves, aren't we organized enough to deal with these three score hooligans? Pamyat is you can see them. They are chauvinistic, they are anti-Semitic, but they also try to sort of vindicate themselves. Their leader, Vasiliev, for instance, says, oh no, I'm not anti-Semitic, here I have Jewish friends, and he will bring some Jewish friends to a meeting also. It's like this.
But isn't this one of the problems of democratization? If you're going to have glasnost, and if you're going to open up the way for people to express political feelings, well then, by definition, there are going to be some of them that you would rather keep quiet, some of them that are rather unpleasant. That's one of the prices you pay for democracy, isn't it?
Well, yes, but I think, you see, when there is democratization, where there's glasnost, freedom of information, and the openness, you see, there will be all sorts of trends, and it's only good to know about these trends. This is thanks to glasnost. This is not the price for democratization. This is the benefit of democratization, that we know of these trends. They make themselves known, and we are alerted to them. And, for instance, I tried to sort of imagine myself at a Pamyat meeting. What would I do? I would not argue with the Pamyat leaders themselves with their ideologists, no. But I would try to separate the other, all other people, because they gather to their meetings sometimes up to 1,000 or more, or 5,000 people. But of course these people are not supporters of this chauvinism, they're just curious to hear what these people are after.
Right, thank you, Murray, for that question. To the next line, Jan from Barnet.
Good morning, Brian, and good morning to your guests. I would like to quickly, firstly, to say to Mr. Young that I think it's oil that has made the country more prosperous, not Thatcher. She's had an enormous bonanza. But I'm a member of the Labour Party, and we've always had a soft spot in our hearts for Russia whilst deploring Stalinism, and we've always applauded their many achievements in turning round a country that was rooted in medievalism in 1916, but which now guarantees homes and jobs, food, medicine for all its people, and has a superb education system, and can send men into space. But Mrs. Thatcher and the Conservatives are deeply opposed to communism and to Russia, and I fear very much that Mr. Gorbachev's so-called love affair with Thatcher is actually doing great harm to the cause of your real friends on the left in Europe, and I know this has been a fear that has been expressed in the press. I feel, for instance, that if Mr. Kinnock were in power, we would indeed be making great strides towards the nuclear-free world Mr. Gorbachev spoke of last night, but which Mrs. Thatcher opposed, and I would like your guest comment on
can
this.
I...
Yes, Hugo Young.
Yes, first of all, I mean, I think that while Mrs. Thatcher's position on the nuclear question is a very major obstacle to all the things that President Gorbachev has been talking about in his visit here, a very profound question. I mean, she actually seems to love nuclear weapons and does not actually foresee any possibility of any rational country getting rid of them, which possesses them. I think it's also, just going back to what something that Boris Beritsky said a little while ago, he did identify her as the first Western leader to really take the importance of perestroika seriously. And one has to say that some of the things that she's been saying during his visit contrast sharply with what, for example, the American government has the attitude they've adopted, both Reagan and Bush, are much, much more cautious, even about wishing Gorbachev well. I mean, she now comes out with sort of total, the total passion of a conviction politician, saying that she hopes that everything he wants to succeed, to achieve, he will succeed in doing. I think that that is something which one has to really recognize and not see her, in that respect at least, as a somehow an obstacle or a deceiver towards Gorbachev.
Boris Belitsky, what do you think of the thrust of the question from Jan, or the fear that she thinks that it's not necessarily a good thing for your leader to have such a good relationship with Mrs. Thatcher?
Well, as far as nuclear weapons are concerned, and that seems to be one of the caller's concerns, I don't think anyone in this country seriously expected an immediate turnabout on the part of Mrs. Thatcher. The important thing, I think, is that a dialogue has begun on this major issue. We have an ongoing dialogue in which each side is presenting its views for and against nuclear weapons. And the fact that you just had this phone call shows that this dialogue is influencing public opinion, public thinking.
Your Moscow LBC phone-in program devoted to Mikhail Gorbachev's visit to Britain. The program was presented by Brian Hayes of the London Broadcasting Company.
And you heard it here on WUSB in Stony Brook as part of our Saturday night call-in program. Those are the kind of calls I'd like to get, folks. So think about it. Give us a call, 632-6901. We are on until midnight, and the thing that's been on my mind over the last week or so is not so much the thawing relations between East and West, although that's nice, it's cheered me up a bit, but what's really troubling me is the Exxon oil spill, which still is very much with us. Now, I looked through Newsday today, I looked through the New York Times today, I did not find one word about the Exxon oil spill in any of those two papers. Now, that's very disturbing because the way I understand it, 360 or so miles of beachfront have been severely polluted by the oil that was spilled off the Exxon Valdez. I guess it's nearly 2 months ago. And only 1 mile has been declared clean. Now, Exxon has said that they will get the whole thing miraculously cleaned up by the end of the summer. Yet in 60 days, they've only managed to clean 1 mile out of over 300. Now, the question I'd like to ask tonight, and the suggestions and comments I'd like to hear from our listeners is, what should we be doing? Does it help to boycott Exxon? Does it help to threaten Exxon to do nasty things to them? Does that accomplish anything? What else can we do? What should Exxon be doing? Well, let's start with that. Let's start by trying to find out what Exxon is doing, since we certainly won't find out in the newspapers. That's something I think we should all be concerned about. We should all contact our newspapers and say, why the hell aren't you carrying this story that is liable to destroy forms of life in a very fragile biological system? Anyway, let's see if the folks at Exxon can lend a light here. Let's see if we can even get to the folks at Exxon on a Saturday night. They're working round the clock, I understand. We'll just see how true that is.
Lane, may I help you?
Yes, operator, we need the number for Exxon, please.
All right, 1 moment.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm sorry, I find no listing.
No listing at all?
No, sir.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Exxon does not have a toll-free number. Isn't that something? I guess they're afraid that people will call it continuously and rack up their bill or something like that. Okay, no problem, no problem. Let's, they must have a number somewhere else, right? We'll track them down.
A telephone, Lasagna, may I help you?
Yes, hi, I'm looking for the main number for Exxon, please.
I'll check one moment.
Thank you.
Please hold, sir.
The number is right area down. Code 212-333-1000.
Well, that's a nice number, isn't it? I guess it helps to be Exxon when you're getting nice phone numbers like that. Let's see if they, they're in tonight and if they can update us as to the situation.
Exxon, the office hours in New York City are from 8:30 a.m. to 4:15 p.m. Monday through Friday. However, in observance of Memorial Day, the offices will be closed until Tuesday, May 30th. Urgent calls for the New York offices may be placed by dialing 212-333-6050. Thank you for calling Exxon.
Thank you. A little recording there. And let's call the urgent number. And anyone else that needs to call the urgent number, by all means, call the urgent number. Call their home numbers. I don't care. Call any number you want. It's important to find out what's going on. This is no trivial matter.
Exxon Security Control Console, Security Officer Munoz speaking. Can I help you?
Yeah. I'm looking for the number that gives updates as to the progress in the oil spill.
Okay, just hold on. Let me look for my supervisor. I'm pretty sure he knows the number.
Thank you very much.
Hold on.
So we know a number exists. Isn't that nice? By assuming that a number exists, by saying to him, I want the number, he said, I'll get the number. So we know the number exists. Whether or not they'll give it to us, that's the tricky part. Waiting for the supervisor to come on the line now. If anyone has any updates on the situation, they can help us out with... Feel free to call us, 632-6901. We'll be going to the phones in just a little while. That's area code 516, for those that don't know where they are, 632-6901. And as I said before, it was just about 2 months ago, worst oil spill, I believe, in history, and certainly not the last. In this day and age of polluted beaches, oil spills, garbage barges, we just have to wonder where is it going to end and how is it going to end? What role do we, as citizens, as individual people, what role are we going to play in this? Now, there was an article earlier in the week in the New York Times, rather. No, actually, I'm sorry, in Newsday, a very interesting article about how the employees of Exxon are under a lot of stress recently because they're getting all this heat from the public. And they get all these letters, these oil-soaked letters in the mail. They get credit cards ripped in millions of pieces. They have to piece all of the credit cards back together in order to figure out what the account number is so they can cancel the account. So it's not a very pleasant job. But it does prove that the whatever movement...
This is Exxon Security. Hi, this speaking.
Yes, hi. I'm trying to find out the number for the updates for the Exxon oil spill.
Okay, the building is closed for the weekend. And if you want to leave your name and number, when they come back Tuesday, they can call you.
I see. Do you have a number of an office that might be open, perhaps in Alaska?
A number for Alaska? This is in New York City.
Yeah, I realize that. I'm looking for an office that would be open now because I need to find out for informational purposes.
Hold on, let me check to see if we have anything.
Thank you. And of course, if I get it, you'll get it. Now, what has happened with the with all this stress that Exxon employees are feeling? It proves that that it's effective. It does get attention. And my question tonight is it justified? Should people be ripping up their Exxon cards and sending them an oil-soaked envelope? Should they be doing other nasty things to Exxon saying horrible things to employees that really didn't have anything to do with the oil spill. Is that an effective way of getting the message across? And maybe there's another effective way that we haven't thought of yet. What should we be doing? 632-6901. As soon as we find out if there is, in fact, a number, we will start taking your phone calls. So get on the line now. We do have some open lines. It's 4 minutes to 11 o'clock. You're listening to WUSB in Stony Brook. The program is Brain Damage. And to get you in the mood, let's talk about beach closings. Yes, it's that wonderful time of year again. Nassau County has hired a private company to be on standby and clean up waste and garbage from the waters off Long Island before the material can wash ashore. Nassau County Executive Thomas Gulotta has said Browning Ferris Industries will form a so-called SWAT team that will be on standby to protect the beaches. Gulotta says, if syringes, sludge balls, and other debris come ashore this summer, we are prepared to protect our country's national asset. Browning Ferris is one of the country's largest solid waste disposal firms experienced in medical waste cleanup. Browning Ferris Vice President Ross...
Okay, I'm checking my listings here in the book, and I have nothing for Alaska. Like I said, this is just, you know, the New York City, the general, you know, information. Again, it's after hours. If you want to leave your name and number, and then when they come back after the holiday, Tuesday,
uh-huh.
Then they can get back and contact you.
Well, I might as well just call them then. But they haven't left any number for updates on the oil spill, in other words.
Oh, no.
Okay. Thank you very much for your help.
That's all. I couldn't help you.
That's okay.
All right.
It wasn't his fault, but obviously there is no number left with the employees for people to find out what's going on. That's... Kind of disappointing in my eyes. Let's finish up this article about beach closings, and then we'll get to the phone calls. Tell us what you think about the Exxon spill. How does it affect you? Have you ripped up your card? And how much is too much, and how much is not enough? Okay, Browning Ferris is one of the country's largest solid waste disposal firms experienced in medical waste cleanup. Browning Ferris Vice President Ross Patton says the SWAT team will conduct a series of cleanup seminars for government agencies. Patton says... The seminar will teach how to differentiate between garbage that poses a health hazard and requires that the beach be closed, and garbage that simply looks bad and has to be removed from the water. And, of course, garbage that looks pleasant and should stay in the water. Browning Ferris will also place special containers for medical waste on the beaches to help with cleanups. Gulotta says there will be a three-pronged defense against beach pollution. He says the U.S. Coast Guard, will be patrolling New York Harbor to look for garbage slicks. Air patrols will fly over Long Island's barrier beaches in the Atlantic Ocean, and now Browning Ferris will be prepared to act from the land. On Thursday, an official with the Long Island Association testified before a state Senate committee that one standard for closing beaches should be used. Mitchell Pally, who is Director of Legislative and Economic Affairs for the Long Island Association, who is pro-shore, by the way, said last summer's beach closings were based on hysteria rather than evidence of unhealthy water. Oh, boy. Pally told the Senate committee that all the medical waste that washed on Long Island beaches last year would have fit into a single shopping bag. That lit up the switchboard like I've never seen it light up before. Okay, we'll see. We'll see how true that is. I mean, one person could have dumped enough to fit in a shopping bag, for God's sake. Anyway, generally, state park officials decide whether to close beaches when they believe the public safety is endangered. Pally said a commission of marine scientists and health officials should decide when beaches should be closed. Yes, the Senate's Environmental Conservation Committee, chaired by Senator Owen Johnson of West Babylon, focused on measures by federal, state, and local officials to spot garbage and clean it up before it reaches the shore. The first garbage slicks, which, by the way, trivia question, anybody, do you know when the first garbage slicks were spotted? Anybody? Okay, July 6th. So it's only May, 28th now, 27th? So it's early yet, you know. The first garbage slicks were spotted on July 6th last year, and they closed Long Beach, Nassau Beach, Jones Beach, Lido Beach, and Robert Moses State Park. Rockaway Beach in New York City was closed July 8th. The closing continued through most of July and created impressions of a massive beach crisis. Now, perhaps that gentleman from the Long Island Association, Mitchell Pally, would be interested in the sewage spill, which occurred only, when did this happen? 2 days ago? Or was it today? Was it yesterday? Okay, it was on Thursday. The Stamford Health Department announced that the Cummings and Cove Island beaches will remain closed through Sunday, pending the outcome of water quality tests after a sewage spill into Long Island Sound from a Darien treatment plant. That was on Thursday morning. The spill, which occurred at 10 a.m., was caused by a malfunctioning pump. Darien health officials said that. Yes, they say it was repaired by 2 p.m. Darien city health officials say the spill dumped between 500,000 and 2 million gallons of sewage. Now, I don't know if you can fit 500,000 or 2 million gallons of sewage into a single shopping bag, but if the Long Island Association can do that, my hat's off to them. But I want to stay away from them nonetheless. The sewage was partially treated with chlorine, so that ought to help us all. Darien health officials say the Pear Tree Point and Weed beaches will remain closed until water quality tests are completed. They say they don't know when the beaches can be reopened. Stamford officials expect to make an announcement about their beaches Sunday afternoon or Sunday evening or sometime in September. And that's the way it's beginning. And before we go to the calls, one thought. Do you think the day will come when we'll just assume the beaches will be closed throughout summer? The beaches are polluted, period. An unpolluted beach, yeah, some kind of fable way back a century or so ago. But you don't go swimming in water. Not in wild water, not in outdoor water. God forbid, you want to get sick or something? And you see, once kids start thinking that, that's the way it is. You know, that's the way it was when I was a kid. That's the way it's going to be forever. So it's very dangerous. Once you get to that point where it's a natural, you know, I mean, we assume now that unpolluted water is natural. But there's going to come a stage where it flips, you know, and the polluted water becomes the natural thing. And unpolluted water is something strange. And when polluted water is the norm, we're not really going to want to clean it up that much because we'll be used to it. What will be the point? You know, it won't be going back to a standard. It will be an improvement that we probably can't afford and probably wouldn't last anyway. Depressing thoughts, I know. So let's get on the phone. 632-6901. Good evening. You're on Brain Damage.
Hi, this is Andrew Goldberger.
Hello, Andrew Goldberger.
Is this 1010 Winds?
I'm sorry?
Is this 1010 Winds?
No, it's not 1010 Winds.
Oh, this is WUSB.
That's right.
I must have dialed wrong.
You must have dialed wrong. What's on your mind?
I have something that... Have you ever heard of a newspaper called Weekly World News?
Of course. I read it every day.
Yeah. Now, this is... You know what it is, right?
I know exactly what it is.
Listen to this. Okay, I got this week's issue.
Andrew, does this have anything to do with what we've been talking about?
No.
Okay, I just wanted to check. Okay, you haven't changed. Go ahead, make it quick.
Okay, exclusive interview with Satan. I just want to read you the 6 questions that I asked. They're very short, okay?
Do you think the person did the interview had to sell their soul to him or just bribe him?
No. He took... He wanted to speak to someone. He took control of a man's body and said, I want to speak to a reporter.
Oh, well, if he took control of him... Oh, okay, that's indisputable then. Go ahead.
Okay, a Spanish journalist claims to have gotten the world's first interview with the devil himself. Okay. Why have you decided to present yourself and talk with a reporter? I want the world and I will have it. It is mine. The children are mine. They will worship me. They will serve me. Together we will destroy everyone, including the Creator. I want all men to know it. I want them to feel the terror that I have promised to bring. How can you destroy the Creator, the ultimate reality, the beginning and the end? He is defeated now and his annihilation, I don't know, is imminent.
Okay, Andrew, I'm trembling here. But if Satan wants to say anything more on our station, he's going to have to apply for a show like everybody else.
All right.
Thanks for calling. 632-6901. Good evening. You're on Brain Damage.
Hey, Eric. How you doing, man?
Okay. How
remember
are you?
Me?
Well, I can't say from the few words you said. Maybe you can give me a hint.
Tom Chong, ring a bell.
Tom.
Yeah.
Okay, that narrows it down to about 30.
Wait, let's talk about this sludge. In
okay, let's do that. Let's do that.
Because I know that's what the topic you really want to get onto.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, so what is this, 2 million gallons of sludge in the Sound?
There's 2 million gallons of sludge in the Sound, at least. That was just Thursday that was dumped. And who knows what else is going to be dumped
and
in
what
there.
Company did this?
Let's see if we can find out exactly what company did that. Okay, it came from a Darien treatment plant.
All I know is Darien's going to get nuked.
Well, yeah, they're very close to...
With my summer, you know?
Well, they don't say anything about the how it's going to affect Long Island. But when you just think of all this sewage being dumped in there, and this is supposedly a good thing, you know, they did this because they were able to turn it off. If they hadn't turned it off, it would have been much worse.
I think it's more like cold murder if you think about it, because when all that sludge gets in the Sound, you know, it kills all the fish.
Yeah, I know. I mean, who are we to be destroying just about every kind of environment that exists? Including the human environment, of course, but...
Yeah, I know. That'll ruin the whole chain of life, you know?
I can't find the name of that company. I'm looking for it. I'm certainly...
I feel like pranking somebody, you know?
Pranking somebody, yeah. Well, find a company in Darien that pours sewage into the water, and you will have probably found
Where
it.
In the Long Island Sound did this occur?
Well, Darien, Connecticut...
Oh, so, all right, yeah, that's like right across, all right.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, you know, I don't know if it's reached any part of Long Island yet, but it's, you know, it's only one part of the whole problem.
Yeah.
We're constantly dumping things into the water. We dump garbage into the water. There's just, you know, we don't know of any other place to put all of our garbage, so we just dump it out at sea where supposedly nobody will see it.
I know, I feel bad for those poor little seals out there in the ocean when they get all that oil on them. You ever see that? When
yeah.
They show, like, when they're cleaning it up. And then all the little seals come up, and they got oil all over them.
Yeah, and the birds, they freeze because the oil takes away whatever protection they have against the cold elements.
Huh? I don't know. It's really sad if you think about it.
Are you boycotting Exxon, and do you even buy things from Exxon? Do you think that's effective?
Well, I don't, like, drive there.
You what?
I haven't really seen any Exxon places around here.
Uh-huh. You don't see Exxon gas stations?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Uh-huh. I think they all closed down.
Well, I mean, if you had an Exxon credit card, would you stop using it? Would you cut it in half and send it to the company? Do you think that's the right thing to do?
I think I'd burn it and give it to that kid Andrew Goldberg because he likes Satan. You know, give it to him, see what he'll do with it.
Okay, well, I guess that's something then.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, well, thanks very much for calling.
Okay, have a nice night.
Okay, have a good holiday.
Hey, bye, Eric.
Bye. 632-6901. Good evening, you're on Brain Damage.
Hey, Eric, what's up?
How you doing?
Not bad. So, about this oil dumping thing.
Uh-huh.
I think we should just get the people who dump it in and dump them in the ocean.
Yeah, sort of go back to the old tradition of dunking people into a bucket of water.
And, like, you know, leave them out there for a few hours and then see if they want to, like, dump anything else in there.
Great idea. You know, we have a picnic, right? We invite all these corporate executives from oil companies to go to a beach party, and you have to go swimming. Yes, that's let's charter a plane and send them all to Alaska and have them stay in the water for like 12 hours or something.
Yeah, and then, like, put, like, you know, the officials and, like, everyone else in there, and, like, you know, parachute people and stuff.
Uh-huh. I'm all for it. Let's come up with more things like that. I mean, I'd like to see some more symbolic action being taken against Exxon. I mean, you know, short of bombing them to hell, I can't think of anything I wouldn't object to. You know?
Yeah. Well, we could send them. We could, like, start, like, you know, prison camps and stuff like that. But
prison camps for oil fishes, yeah.
Fishes and stuff.
Yeah. You know what really gets me here is the fact that oil prices have gone up as a result, which means they're not even covering the loss. We're paying for their mistake.
Yeah, true.
Now, you may question that. You may say, well, I mean, the oil company didn't deliberately spill oil in the waters. It was one drunken captain that was responsible. True. One human being made a mistake. But how could one human being cause so much catastrophe if something isn't inherently wrong in the system? The system should be able to protect itself against somebody deliberately screwing up. I mean, going out there and saying, I'm going to dump all this oil. which he didn't do. But if somebody was to do that, the system should be able to prevent it somehow. The system here did not work at all, and that's what Exxon should pay for and pay through the nose. Perhaps they should go out of business if they have to pay too much for them to cover. But we shouldn't be paying for it. You know, human beings, individual people, we didn't do it. It was this monolithic oil company.
Yeah, true. Well, did they, like, get rid of the captain and everything?
Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously, he's at fault here, but I think maybe he's being blamed a little bit too much. As I said, he was one person who has a problem. His problem has been translated into a problem for just about everybody in the country now. Something is wrong when that can happen.
It's true. It's like a lot of people like must want to like kill this guy or something, you know?
Yeah, and you know, you could also say that that boycotting Exxon gas stations, you're only hurting individual people, just like you'd be hurting Captain Hazelwood if you wanted to hurt him. They're all individual people, true. But they'll get feedback. Exxon Oil Company will get feedback from Exxon Oil dealers saying, we're not doing any business, and it's because you people screwed up. And maybe I'm going to change my affiliation now and go to Shell or something like that. Or maybe I'm just going to get out of the business altogether and open a hardware store. In the long run, Exxon does hurt from whatever you say against Exxon. Make no mistake about that.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, a lot of little people are going to hurt along the way, either way, if we say something or if we don't say something. There have to be sacrificial lambs sometimes, and that's unfortunate.
That's true.
But maybe if we would support the people running the Exxon station and you know, take them out to lunch or something and convince them to close their station for a week or something like that, if we took care of them for a week. I don't know. Maybe that would be something fairly nice to do. I don't know. Just something off the top of my head.
Oh, and the thing that gets me is that, like, you see all the animals and what's happening to them, and they're talking about getting this stuff out of the water, but what are they going to do, like, for the animals that already suffer from this?
There's nothing they can do. I mean,
you know, they could, like, put them someplace and, like, maybe, like, help them or something, but they just leave them out there.
Uh-huh.
Doesn't seem like they do anything for
them. I'm not, you know, a person that knows a lot about the biology involved here, but I imagine once you get coated with oil, it's pretty close to the end for wild animals at that point. Some, I believe, the polar bears are able to survive at first, but once the oil starts getting into their food chain, once they start ingesting it, they're going to start feeling the consequences, too. And this is going to mess up things. You know, it's not going to be over when they clean things up. It's an effect that's going to go on for a long time. And I don't think there is a way to recover from it.
Yeah.
You know, so there is no simple solution. You know, driving Exxon out of business isn't going to make this problem go away. But perhaps it will make any other oil company say, we better be damn careful because we don't want this to happen to us.
Yeah.
We don't want what happened to Exxon to happen to us because we want to stay in business.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks for calling.
Yes, you're welcome.
Okay.
Have a nice night.
You too.
Okay.
632-6901, area code 516. Good evening. You're on brain damage.
Yeah, how you doing?
Okay, how are you?
What are we talking about, jello stuff?
What?
What are we talking about, the brown jello stuff in the water?
Yeah, right. You've seen some of it, eh?
Yeah, I can't stand that.
It's just not the way it used to be.
Yeah, you know what I hate worse is when you be swimming in the sand and you like run into warm spots and you see some little kid like swimming away. I hate that.
Wait, you see some little kid swimming away?
Yeah, you'd be swimming into a warm spot in the water.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. But that's believe me, that's sunshine compared to what we're talking about today.
Yeah, no really. Hang on, guys, please. Oh shit. Sorry.
Okay.
All right. Okay, I'm back.
You're back. Anything else you have to say?
Oh, what is it? Wait, who's this company that's dumping all this stuff now? Is there something incorporated in this?
It's a company in Darien, Connecticut.
Where's that? What's that near? Is that near Bridgeport?
You know, I'm not really familiar with the geography of Connecticut. I'm sorry about that. I know our listeners in Connecticut will be getting roped to lynch me with now. I don't really know, okay? It borders on the Long Island Sound. That's that much I can tell you. If somebody can help me out there, I'd appreciate it.
Alrighty.
So, that's the deal there. But you know, again, I should say this is only one of many instances. It's not the only thing happening. There's sewage spills every day in this country, and this certainly won't be the last one.
Worse. It's getting worse. Yeah, what you said before, sooner or later, we're not going to be, you know, you're going to take it for granted that the sound's going to be all brown and not blue and green anymore.
Uh-huh. Not to mention all the lakes and streams and
exactly
every other body of water that exists.
The fish aren't going to be there anymore.
Nope. I believe there was an article in the Times today about not being able to eat fish caught upstate because they're contaminated.
Oh, yeah?
I mean, what can you do? You can't eat fish anymore. I wouldn't eat fish. You don't know where it's been. You don't know how polluted it is. It's disgusting.
I haven't eaten fish. I guess in flesh, yeah.
And fish is supposed to be healthy. You know, it's supposed to be good for you. But how can anybody, you know, take that chance? Even if you catch it yourself, you still don't know. You know, you don't know what's in the water.
Yeah, really. I haven't been to the ocean. I've been to the Sound this year, but I mean, I haven't been to the ocean since 2 years ago. And last year was all the ocean dumping and stuff, but I wasn't there last year.
Uh-huh.
I was there like 2 years ago, and that was it.
Well, let's wait and see what happens this summer.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks for calling.
All right, talk to you later.
632-6901. Good evening. You're in Brain Damage.
I'm over my friend Larry and Debbie's house.
Uh-huh.
And we're listening to the radio about the sludge.
Yeah.
You know, the sludge in the water and the needles and the excrement.
Yeah.
And we live where there's water, and I don't go in the water because of the stuff in the water.
Uh-huh.
And Vicky don't either.
Uh-huh. And how long have you not gone in the water for?
Well, since this needle started floating around in the water. They're out there bobbing around. Sometimes you see tampons out there. You see all kinds of stuff out there.
That was, when did you first start noticing this?
We live in San Remo.
In where?
San Remo.
I'm not familiar where that is.
It's next to Leo's place.
Oh, wow. What town?
Kings Park. San Remo is part of Kings Park, but it's San Remo.
Okay.
That's the town.
Right.
Well, anyway, 5 years ago it was pretty lousy out here.
Uh-huh.
But we're by a psychiatric center, and a lot of stuff gets thrown in, a lot of medical waste.
You're saying Kings Park Psychiatric Center? Was,
yeah, it's right
in
down the,
water.
The river.
Uh-huh.
We're going to the river Monday.
What's that, the Nissaquag?
The Nissaquag River. They canoe in the Nissaquag.
Uh-huh.
Amid
yeah.
all of this medical waste.
There's medical waste in the Nissaquag River?
It possibly is, because that's where they dump it from, Kings Park Psychiatric.
You're telling me that Kings Park Psychiatric Center dumps waste into the Nissaquag River?
This is a known fact.
Uh-huh.
You know what? The problem is, they import their help from Pennsylvania at the psychiatric center,
uh-huh.
And them woodchucks, they don't know how they throw it right in the river.
Well, that's something that we should look into.
Well, I can't. I don't have the time.
Okay. Well, thanks for bringing it to my attention. I'll take a trip over there and check it out for myself.
Okay.
Any other words of wisdom or suggestions?
Not at all.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Good night.
632-6901. If that is true, I will certainly let the folks know about it, but we're not indicting any mental hospitals tonight. 632-6901, area code 516. Good evening, you're on Brain Damage.
Hi, Eric. It's Dave from Northport.
Hi, how are you?
All right, speaking of Exxon, I wish that I had a better answer for you than for the American people to rise up against this. But I don't think we have any power stronger than us all banding together or something in that effect.
Well, so far, 15,000 people have sent in their Exxon cards in one form or another. Now, I don't know how many people have Exxon cards, and I know, you know, as far as the total population of the country, that may not seem like much, but believe me, the 15,000 people to get together and do something like this, you better believe Exxon is taking notice of it.
Well, considering that Exxon is probably one of the strongest powers, makes the most profit in the world.
I believe it's the largest oil company. I'm not sure about that, but I believe it is.
They are not very socially conscious about this oil spill. I think they should take a loss for the year and just put as many people on the scene as they need. And I realize that a lot of innocent owners are getting hurt by their company's fault. But I think that is the only way to go about it.
Uh-huh.
you did happen to miss, there was an article in Time magazine last week, not a very large article, but there was, they're getting some press coverage, and they said the chairperson of Exxon is making $1.4 million a year, and the article is suggesting that he should take some of his, a personal pay cut.
Yeah, I certainly would think so. I mean, I can't really speak for what I would do if I was in his position, but if I somehow woke up and found myself to be the chairman of Exxon making $1.4 million a year, I would probably, you know, if I woke up tomorrow and found that to be true, I'd just immediately quit and give all that money to the relief effort. And I think he should do something like that. Certainly not be a part of Exxon anymore if he doesn't feel proud of what his company has done.
I'm personally banning Exxon. No, I don't think it'll have an appreciable effect. I'm putting my $20 of gas in my car a week.
It will, though, because your action may, but you know, by saying it on the radio tonight, you may have convinced somebody else to do the same thing. Pat Halpin, county executive of Suffolk County, banned Exxon from, cut up all the Exxon credit cards for Suffolk County cars. That's a significant step. Perhaps he wouldn't have done that if he had not heard of somebody else doing that. So it's a stepping stone. And as long as we keep talking to other people about it, the communications channel will make this a powerful statement, one way or the other.
Well, I just hope it doesn't get burnt down in the news like most stories.
Well, it already is. I couldn't find it in the newspaper today at all. And that's something that we can't allow to happen. That should be in the newspaper every day. There should be, like the Iran hostage crisis, there should be day one, day two. What's the progress? You know, how many miles are clean? How many miles are polluted? How many animals have died that we know of?
Well, the first thing that came to my mind was, remember when the whales were stuck in Alaska?
Uh-huh.
This is a worldwide effort, and this is on the news.
Two whales, right. And those two whales are probably dead now as a result of the Exxon oil spill.
And I can't, that coverage got so much publicity compared to the millions of animals suffering today. I don't know where the American people went. They banned the whales, and they're leaving millions of animals to die.
Well, you can't blame the American people entirely. Of course, it is partially their fault for not demanding more coverage, but it is the news networks that aren't pursuing this story vigorously. Now, the two whales stranded were, you know, that's a nice human interest story, even though it's about whales. You know, it's one of those soft news things. Now, Exxon oil spill gets kind of tedious after a while. What can you say? Well, there's different angles. There's different ways you can approach it. You know, you can look at Exxon's corporate structure. You can look at exactly what's being done on a day-to-day basis. Go with one of the cleaning crews and watch them for a whole period of time. There's allegations that they aren't really cleaning things up. They're just staying on the boat all day long, and they don't really know what to do.
Well, the American government said they may move in on it. I hope Exxon cleans up before the taxpayers start paying for it.
The American government should move in. Every government should move in. I mean, this isn't just American waters we're polluting. It's affecting the entire world because water tends to move around quite a bit. So I don't think any government would be wrong in sending in any kind of help to clean this up, even though it's going to take a very long time.
Very long time.
It won't be 100% effective. There's irreparable damage here.
And I just wanted to add something on a local level.
Uh-huh.
I probably have not been in the Long Island Sound since I was about 6 years old. Being from Northport, there's always that reminder, you see the barge out in the Sound.
Uh-huh.
And when I was very young, I realized there was black stuff in the water, and I did not know what it was. But it probably kept me away from going swimming in my own ocean, which is kind of a sad story itself.
It is a sad story. I mean, you know, people don't swim in Port Jefferson Harbor either. And increasingly on beaches. There's oil everywhere, there's garbage, there's, you know, I don't know about syringes and things like that. I've never actually seen one in the water, but I know they're out there. And there's pollution you can't see, too.
I just wish people would take better care of Earth. It's like the only resource we have, and we're destroying it.
That's true. And when Magellan gets to Venus, we're going to learn something about why that planet is 800 degrees on the ground, why the greenhouse effect has been completed on Venus. And who knows, maybe we'll find a bunch of Earth people there with a warning to us. That would be something, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Okay, Eric, I wish you the best of luck.
Okay, thanks.
Enjoy your weekend.
Okay, with that theory I just came up with, I'm going to need the best of luck. 632-6901, good evening, you're on Brain Damage.
Hi, this is Steve, and I have a few suggestions for you.
Okay.
The first thing is, as and you've hit upon it a number of times, and that is the fact that it's the media. And the media is absolutely the number one cause of public interest, and which spawns on these companies. The previous caller mentioned the thing about the whales, and I think the thing that got the people so interested about the whales is the fact that it was very suspenseful type thing. It was almost like a novel or something where, you know, you had these whales in the water and they only gave them a week to live or whatever, and then one of them dropped out and they assumed he died, and the other two went on and they finally got freed. The Russians helped out and everything. Whereas with the oil spill, you know, it's a very humdrum type thing, day in, day out. It's a very slow process, and to rebuild the ecology of the area in Alaska, it's a very slow thing, and people aren't interested in, you know, today they saved three seagulls, and tomorrow they're still working on cleaning up another 100 yards of beaches.
Yes, but you see, it's only slow because they can't think of an imaginative way of presenting the story. What if they were to study the life of seagulls, you know, to watch how seagulls go through an average day, you know, and people could sort of follow that and say, wow, seagulls are cool, you know, we shouldn't be destroying them. And then, you know, that's only one form of life. There's thousands of forms of life there that we're not even familiar with. We should be studying them, seeing what they look like when they're not being destroyed, and then take a good look at what they look like when they are destroyed, and that will hit home. That will make people say, my God, what's going on here? We've got to do something.
Well, you could be right. Somehow I don't feel that way. Like, for instance, the taping that you played, which replaced Moscow Mailbag this week,
uh-huh.
They were talking about, one of the callers mentioned the mass executions that they had in the Ukraine, and the Soviet correspondent, the guest there, he said, well, we want to forget about that, and some of the people are kind of nostalgic for Stalin, and these people, they're old and everything. And I think what it basically came down to was the fact that the free world, the democratic nations of the world, have kind of forgotten about that. They, unlike the... very anti-Nazi, and, you know, and the Russians as well, so, and of course the Israelis, so that the Nuremberg cases were something which were very, which many, many people could identify with. Now, I'm a Jew, a Russian Jew at that, at least half Russian Jew, and, you know, and I can identify with these mass executions because of the Holocaust. But the difference there is that in the Ukraine, everything is contained. The Russians have been able, or the Soviets have been able to contain the publicity of that action. And therefore, I guess it's about 60 years later or so. No, not that much. 50. They're able to suppress it so that the entire world's forgotten about that. And I think that that's where you see the injustices which are occurring in this society, is when everything turns into a commercial. All our when our old commercials 20 years ago, when you see old commercials, they used to come on and they would say how great our project is because it did this, that, and the other thing, you know, and now you see commercials, they look like MTV videos, and you don't even know what you're buying anymore. And so I think you hit upon it before, and it's the media is the... And Peter Jennings has more of a responsibility than just telling us what's going on. He should tell us the whole truth and nothing but the truth, because it's...
Well, don't forget, the truth is relative. You know, some people will say that's the truth. Some people will say that's propaganda.
That's the Soviets' method. I think that this perestroika thing is a lot more propaganda than it is truth. I think Soviet society is not a lot different from what it was 4 years ago before Gorbachev came on. One Yeltsin is nothing compared to the other thousands of conservative Soviet officers, and plus all the people that follow them.
Well, I'm dying to see what the next few years will bring in the Soviet Union and in China too. Here,
I think
things sound
much more promising.
Yeah, I do too. I do too, because millions of students. Getting together like that, although some people have said they're rather naive. They want no more corruption, something very simplistic like that. They're not aware of the complexities. But still, sometimes complexities make things a lot more unattainable than they have to be. Sometimes you need to just forget about them and go back to the simple basic wants and needs, and everything kind of works out in the end. But I think more important than what's happening in the Soviet Union, more important than what's happening in China, and more important than what's not happening here, we have to, all of us, Third World and all the other countries, get together and realize this is our planet. And whatever political systems are transpiring, whatever revolutions and demonstrations are taking place, doesn't mean anything if we destroy the planet. That should be primary, saving the environment.
Well, I think, you know, the previous caller said, what difference does it make if it's just $20 a week or whatever? But if you really look at the way that these the Soviets respond and the Japanese and everything, and the, like, for instance, the whale ships that they've stopped now, and if you really study them carefully, and even the Nicaraguans, if you look at them carefully, you can see that they really do care about public opinion. They care about what the West thinks of them. They care about what their own countrymen think of them. You know, the Soviets are probably ecstatic about being able to finally have free elections, although not a big change. Some is better than none. And the fact that, you know, that even the smallest things, you know, have, as you said, they're stepping stones, and small things inspire bigger things. You can't change the world in a day. If you look at a lot of these revolutions, like the French and Russian Revolution, you see that a revolution means quick change, and what you really see is revolutions are just followed by new dictatorships and new tyrannies. And but if you take it from a slow, steady standpoint, and if you show that people really do care, I think that these countries will respond.
I think perhaps what the Soviet Union has discovered is the power of world media. When they do things that make the world media look positively upon them, suddenly there aren't as many things in the way.
It's like the situation with Armenia, where Gorbachev went to visit Armenia, and that looked very good. The only thing was, he was the only person there. The Soviet government were not sending their soldiers and all that, not nearly as many as they really should have. I don't know what the situation there is now, but that certainly has left the media limelight. And so you know, from that example, you can immediately see that publicity is everything, and even though he may not have been sending in medical supplies and everything, in fact, many free world countries were having problems getting medical supplies through customs trying to get it into Armenia because the Russians didn't want to make it look as if they needed help from outside. They wanted to be able to show that they could take care of it themselves. And, you know, that's a perfect example of how it's not so much what they actually do, but it's what they project to the general public, because, after all, it's not what actually happened, it's what everyone thinks happened. And
that's, yeah, it's an important distinction. Well, sir, thank you very much for calling.
All right, sure. Bye-bye.
Our telephone number is 632-6901. World media is what it's all about. It's one thing we didn't have 100 years ago. We didn't have TV and radio, ways of actually getting out and reaching people that don't read newspapers, or people that do read newspapers, an instantaneous way of showing what is actually happening through pictures and through sounds. That's a very important medium. It's something that is essential. And by influencing the media, we will get what's important to us out onto the airwaves by stressing to the media that the oil disaster has to be covered more. More people will hear about it. More people will be outraged by it. The oil companies will feel the pressure. The government will feel the pressure. And something will be done. Because pressure from the people can be felt very intensely, but first the word has to get out to the people, and that is what the media is for. If the media doesn't give the information, then there's no way for the people to react. The Chinese students heard about what was going on through various media, including the Voice of America, which later was jammed. We need the same kind of action here. We need the same kind of spreading of the word. And if the New York Times and ABC News don't feel it's of interest to cover what's happening today with the oil disaster that occurred 2 months ago, then we have to contact them and let them know that they're wrong. Our number is 632-6901. We have three open lines. We're going to play a musical selection, and then we're going to come back. Let's fill up those three lines. 632-6901, area code 516. Debbie McClatchy, who I saw last week, and that's why I wasn't here.
Call me the whale, for that's what I am, and that's what I aim to be. You may call yourself the king of the land, but I am the king of the sea. Brave boy, yes, I am the king of the sea. I never ever meant you any harm, brave boy, when I sent you to the bottom with my tail. I only meant to show you that you should have been at home instead of on the ocean chasing whales. Brave boy, instead of on the ocean chasing whales. But you never got the message, so more and more you came, till I ran out of places for to hide. When your boat got so big that I could not bring you down, then I knew you had turned the tide. Brave boy, I knew you had turned the tide. So now you
That's Debbie McClatchy here on WUSB. Call Me the Whale. The words were written by Paul Kaplan. And Debbie says on the album sleeve, there is nothing so beautiful and graceful as a mother whale and her calf playing in the morning sea. And nothing so senselessly arrogant as man's destruction of this peaceful creature so that he might smell more pleasing and oil the gears of his mechanized society. And that song, set to the tune of an old whaling song, aptly tells the story from the whale's standpoint. You may think it's silly, you may think it's wasteful to think of things from the whale's point of view, but the day will come when there won't be any more whales, when there won't be anything other than pictures and stories from the past. That day is rapidly approaching unless we change something very basic in the way we do things. We have to ask, oh, where is all the waste that I produce going? Am I producing waste that nobody knows what to do with? And if so, can I change my habits, do something a little bit differently so that I don't contribute to this problem? Am I wearing animal furs that I don't have to wear? Am I using parts of whales for my everyday life, or parts of any other animal for that matter? Some people are vegetarians, some people aren't. You don't have to be to be concerned. You don't have to be effective in what you do and what you don't do. Our number is 632-6901. We still got a couple of lines open, so let's fill those up, and we'll go back to the phone calls. Area code 516-632-6901. We're talking about the oil spill, about what Exxon should do and what we should do to Exxon. 632-6901. And in the New York Times, I guess a couple of weeks ago, this is from, the black stains left by the Exxon Valdez have left a mark not only on Prince William Sound, but also on Alaska's political landscape, blotting out much of the influence that the oil industry has enjoyed in state government for the last decade. Those changes were swift in the Alaska legislature, which ended its 1989 session, that was a couple of weeks ago in Juneau, by bucking the oil industry and passing bills to protect the environment more and impose huge fines on oil spillers. But the most dramatic sign was the sudden victory for state Democrats in their three-year effort to repeal tax breaks enjoyed by the oil companies. Those tax breaks, worth $150 million a year to the companies, were intended to encourage exploration in economically risky oil fields, but some critics felt the companies were getting too big a break for too little risk. And until the March 24th disaster, which fouled one of Alaska's most spectacular waterways with nearly 11 million gallons of North Slope crude oil, the tax changes had been given only a slight chance of getting to the floor of the state Senate, let alone passing. It was virtually dead until the Exxon Valdez incident, said Senate President Tim Kelly, an Anchorage Republican who had counted himself among the chamber's pro-oil majority, a coalition reminiscent of the coal and railroad interests that used to control many legislatures in the lower 48. The oil industry just was not credible anymore, said Governor Steve Cowper. Up until the spill, a large number of Alaskans were content to take industry statements at face value without questioning them, he said. Since the spill, a lot of people have been looking at industry statements with a lot of skepticism. I think that the spill will cause a permanent change in the political chemistry in Alaska, said Governor Cowper, who is a Democrat. It's hard to say specifically what that will mean, except that I'm sure there's been a terminal loss of patience with any industry equivocation on environmental matters. Senator Kelly said the Valdez disaster changed attitudes fundamentally. I just can't say hard enough how much that incident reached into the souls of Alaskans, he said. I know the legislature was in shock for about 2 weeks after the incident. And we should be in shock, too. It's not something that just happened in Alaska. It's something that happened to all of us, not just in the United States, either. And it's something that will happen many, many more times unless we're loud, vocal, and successful in what we say. Let's hear what you have to say. Area code 516-632-6901. We have 13 minutes to go. 516-632-6901. Good evening. You're on Brain Damage.
Yeah, hello, Eric.
Yo.
You're Sammy.
Hi, Sammy. How are you?
Yeah, you're talking about the flood?
Yeah, that's what we're doing.
Yeah. I went to the beach last year.
Uh-huh.
And it was more needles in the beach than it was in my backyard.
Uh-huh.
That's a lot of needles, man.
That's must be a hell of a lot of needles, yeah.
Filthy.
It certainly is.
You know where I live now?
Where's that?
Over in Roosevelt.
Roosevelt, huh?
You know where that is?
Yes, I do.
Near Hollis.
Uh-huh.
And over there,
well,
over there, you see the needles floating by in the rainwater, in the gutter.
Uh-huh.
You know, and maybe the needles wash out to the sea, so there ain't nobody dumping them in the water. They're just floating. So
well, I had heard that they get sucked into, what, the street sewers or whatever, and then out into the water. Yeah, so, I mean, individual contributions to this whole mess are effective. Yes, if we drop things in the street, they could end up in the ocean, certainly. So that's why we all have to look out for things like that. I'm sorry?
You know that you said that the garbage, the medical waste in that's out in the water is only filled a shopping bag?
Uh-huh. Well, I didn't say that. No, that was some guy from the Long Island Association that said that.
Somebody that didn't know his P from his Q's. I think that you could fit almost like 1,000 needles in a shopping bag.
Uh-huh.
In fact, my cousin could prove it.
That may be so, but I think we all know that there's a lot more than a shopping bag full of waste on the beaches. And, you know, it really, the more I think about what that guy said, the more it annoys me, because even if the situation was exaggerated, you know, why shouldn't it be? Because obviously there's a lot of pollution in the water. We should know about this, and we shouldn't even risk downplaying it.
What I'm worried about is the AIDS virus on the needles on the beach.
Well,
it's from a needle on the beach.
You can't
My cousin, he don't live in New York. He lives in Detroit.
Uh-huh.
He got AIDS from a pocket meter.
I don't think that's possible. I don't think it's possible to get AIDS from any...
You don't get AIDS from no pocket meter.
No, you...
Touching a dirty pocket meter, what, are you crazy?
No, you can't do that.
No.
No.
We all know that, because I got that form in the mail from Everett Koop.
Uh-huh. See Everett Koop, who is resigning, by the way.
Oh, he's quitting.
Yeah, he's quitting.
He's probably been fired. He ain't quitting.
He probably did get a lot of flack for his positions.
He gave it to the Parker
Meter. I mean, he was very anti-tobacco lobby. He was very pro-education on AIDS, so that goes against the current administration, I know. So he might have gotten some flack, but I don't think that would cause him to resign. I think he's too strong for that.
Well, he got a funny beard. He got no mustache, just a beard.
Yeah, like Abe Lincoln.
Kind of Quaker.
Uh-huh.
Well, we do.
Yeah, well, I have to say I admire him. I think he's been very effective.
Try to put his head in front of a full-page ad that says, look out for AIDS, and put his face there. He got some brass, I'll tell you right now.
Yes, that's true. Any closing thoughts, Sammy?
No, I just hope that none of the whales run into any of them needles.
Yeah, well, let's hope they don't run into a lot of other things that we've put there.
Okay.
Thanks for calling.
Good night, man.
Good night. And in case people think I'm coming down too hard on the human race, you know, remember, we're all a part of the human race, and what we contribute to it is what makes the human race. So, something to think about. 632-6901, we lost just about all our calls, so please, if you want to call in, you have about only a few minutes to go, and we want to hear what you have to say. It's very important that we hear what our listeners have to say. 632-6901. Good evening, you're on Brain Damage.
Oh, that was easy.
That was easy, wasn't it? A lot of people don't know how easy it is.
Yeah, well, the combination of the Valdez talk and your discussion about whales caught my attention. Just only have a couple things to contribute.
Okay.
One, I was in Canada twice last month. One weekend in Montreal, the other weekend in Quebec. And interestingly, their coverage of the Valdez incident was quite different. They showed piles of dead bodies of animals that had been oiled, when in fact, here in the States, via ABC TV, Peter Jennings, or something equivalent thereof, you really only saw one or two. And it doesn't even have to be a justified comparison, because what the viewer perceives on his or her busy job schedule is in reality the type of coverage that is being produced. So comparing a little window of observation between what happened here in via news coverage and what happened there, it's really quite different. Amazingly different, in fact. And the Canadians are, even though their shoreline may not have been damaged, or at least not yet, they have a completely different view of the situation. And
yeah.
And it's created a fair amount of anger.
I think they're a lot more progressive in the way they look at these things. They do tend to talk more about pollution. The whole acid rain conflict has affected Canadian American relations quite a bit. And you raise a very good point. The way the media covers something influences the way we think about it. I mean, Canadian people probably think the Exxon oil disaster is much worse than American people think, simply because of the way they have seen it in the media.
Yes.
And that's so important. We have to pressure the media to show what's really going on, since you know, we've heard what's really going on. We know what's really happening. Why aren't we seeing it? Those are the questions we have to ask.
The only other thing I wanted to contribute is that the whole situation would be very, very different if the disaster had occurred pretty much now or within the next month.
Why is that?
During the gray whale migration north, gray whales would have come in contact with the oil slick directly, which would be devastating, because when baleen is oiled, it no longer functions as a filtration device for the whales to filter food from the water. And this remarkable gray whale comeback, since the species was declared endangered in the 1920s, would have been for naught, and 60, 70 years of progress would have been destroyed.
Wow.
That's exactly what very likely would have happened, and it would have created an entirely different situation. Instead of 15,000 cards being destroyed, may have been more akin to 15 million, if there are even that many, because of the public sensitivity towards the whale issue.
That's something. If there's any fortunate news to come out of this, that's certainly a part of it. Are you sure, though, that they won't be affected by what's the oil that is still there?
Likely not. It's probably been I don't know how much has been collected. Haven't been following it that closely, unfortunately. But I do know that by now, much of it would have been diluted down in terms of a total, a million gallons to a total Pacific Northwest Coast type of sea volume. It'd be pretty much diluted by now, and it wouldn't affect baleen in such a devastating way. It takes concentrated oil, like a whale, to come in contact with oil within the first 4 weeks of the disaster, directly in the endemic area, for it to have that type of effect. So it shouldn't really happen.
Uh-huh.
Some may die now due to secondary causes, due to affecting the local food chain. But it wouldn't be the disaster wouldn't be affecting the top of the food chain like it would have been, that the theoretical prediction.
I see. Well, the danger, of course, still exists that something like that could happen again, and this time it could affect the whales a lot more
right.
than it did.
So in some ways, Exxon has lucked out with the whole thing.
Very, very few ways they've lucked out. I mean,
right.
The way, well, two major ways. Of course, the fact that the whales weren't affected as much as they could be, and the way that the American media has been handling it. I think they lucked out as far as that goes,
right.
Too.
Yeah. Mm. Very good.
So maybe public reaction, such as people sending in their Exxon cards and boycotting Exxon and saying nasty things to them, maybe that will spur the media into covering it a little bit more. You know, media likes to hit people when they're down. Well, okay, if we can get Exxon down, then maybe they'll hit Exxon a little harder.
Right.
Thanks very much for calling.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
632-6901. Good evening. You're on Brain Damage.
Hello?
Sammy, is that you again?
No. This is Dr. Fodor Dhidan.
You must be related to Sammy. Oh, what's up? What's up?
I work at the Kings Park Central Ice, the Secretary Acrylic.
Yeah, you must be from Pennsylvania.
No, psychiatric.
Right. Yeah, I had a feeling we'd get a call from somebody from there.
Hey, I don't know the man in charge of the medical waste, the red bag waste.
Uh-huh.
But I know we do not throw it in the river.
Okay. Well, I'm glad somebody stated that tonight because that gets me off the hook. But I will be taking a trip over there.
I cannot vouch for the woodchucks.
I have to take a trip over there. In fact, I have to once a week. But I'll check it out while I'm there, and
who can prove you can bring a needle that has pierced your skin from the river, and it says King's Park Psychiatric Facility on it? I will give you $100 per needle.
$100, eh?
Bring me bandages, says KP on it. I will. There's no waste from us in that river.
Yes, very.
It is like sacred, like the Ganges.
I understand. Hold on a minute. Okay, great. We transferred him to the psych ward, and that's where he will stay. Thanks very much for everybody who called in and to those people that expressed an interest in what is going on. And I hope other people out there that didn't call in also express an interest some way about what's happening, because we're talking about future generations, your future generations, and the world that that waits for them. Will it be a clean world or a filthy, dirty one that people will be afraid to swim in water, to breathe the air, to do anything, I guess, anything natural? A lot of things, a lot of questions that we have to ask ourselves, and a lot of changes that have to be made. And this Exxon oil spill is something to be learned, a lot to be learned from it, and a lot to mourn over. But we have to look upon every little disaster that happens as something to learn from and something eventually to benefit from. And I believe there is a way to benefit from this if we don't ignore it. And we don't allow the media to ignore it, like the New York Times, like Newsday did today. We have to make sure that this is in the news every day, and that we know exactly what's being done. And we'll be talking about this in the weeks to come. Thanks again to everybody that called in. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Not me.